Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the director of the school, it's a pleasure to welcome you all here to what I hope will be the first of a series of debates organised jointly by Fleming's European Forum and the European Institute within the school. The theme is a very topical one: economic and monetary union, German views for and against. To debate this, we have a distinguished panel and a distinguished discussant. The questioning will be led by David Marsh, Director of European Strategy at Robert Fleming, and I pass over the organisation of our debate to David.
Well, thank you, Howard. Yes, I'm very pleased to be here and also to have invited such a very distinguished group of panellists. Since war seems to have broken out between Germany and Britain over beef, it's all the more surprising, maybe, that five such prominent and erudite Germans have come here to talk about monetary union and to have a German debate in Britain. And I would like to introduce our panellists very briefly. First of all, Herr Michael Ruskau, who has come from the German Finance Ministry today. He is the Deputy Director General for International Monetary Affairs at the Finance Ministry. He also leads a working group to look at the whole technicalities of economic and monetary union at the Finance Ministry, and therefore is very much involved in the whole technical preparations for EMU. Thomas Kielinger, he is known as the voice of Germany. He's much better known in Britain, he tells me, than he is in Germany, because he somehow occupies whole programmes on the BBC for hours at a time. I think he has been the only German to appear on Any Questions, and we confidently expect him shortly to become a British citizen and after that to be made a lord. Robert Bischoff, on my right, is one of the best known industrialists in Britain, despite the fact, or maybe because of the fact, that he is German. Robert works for Jung Heinrich, the Hamburg engineering company, which took over 2 years ago the forklift truck company in Leighton Buzzard called Lancer Boss. And Lancer Boss has since been renamed Boss. Even though he wears very good suits, this is not actually a reflection of his sartorial excellence. It is the fact because he is the boss at Boss, and this is why it has been renamed Boss. And Bob has done for Leighton Buzzard what the odd Saudi prince sometimes does for wastelands in the desert. He's turned Leighton Buzzard now into an oasis of manufacturing splendour with the new investment that is going in for this forklift truck company, which, according to him, is now one of the best forklift truck companies in the world. And I think he's quite well known in left-wing circles here. He's even been portrayed in a newspaper recently as Dr. Bob, the heartthrob of the left, or something similar to that. On the right, Professor Michael Stürmer, who is as well known in Britain as he is in Germany, that is to say, very well known. Professor Stürmer, he looks very English, but he's actually German. He speaks on the BBC a great deal. He advises chancellors past, present, and future. And he is particularly close to the German president, Mr. Herzog. He is the director of the government foreign policy think tank in Ebenhausen, Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik. And he is really as much an expert on strategic and military affairs as he is on all things economic. And then on my extreme left, Professor Wilhelm Nulling, who is a professor at Hamburg University. Wilhelm has been undergoing has been carrying out a sort of crusade in Britain this week to talk about monetary union from the standpoint of a man who was a politician in the Bundestag, who was also a minister in the Hamburg government in the 1970s, and between 1982 and 1992 was a member of the Bundesbank Council in his position as the president of the Land Central Bank in Hamburg. Wilhelm is a man of great intellect and passion. Last night I said it round the other way, and he criticised me afterwards for putting the emotional side of him first. He is somebody who clashed on several occasions with Chancellor Kohl over questions of economic and monetary union for Germany and for Europe, and therefore actually became quite famous during his time at the Bundesbank. He, I think I could say, he is the poet of the Bundesbank because he quotes the Bard quite frequently. And of course, his most famous line, I believe, is this famous line from Heinrich Heine, Denk ich an Euro in der Nacht, bin ich meine Mark gebracht. So we will be hearing from Wilhelm later on. Now, to open the proceedings, and I do have to say I'm going to be very strict disciplinarian over this because we've got five absolutely superb speakers, and to allow them to give of their best, we're going to have to keep proceedings fairly pithy and short, which obviously applies to me as much as to anybody else. But I'm going to ask everybody to start off for simply 5 minutes with some points. And I'm going to ask Michael Ryska to start off to tell us, from the point of view of the German Finance Ministry, why Europe needs a euro.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I feel quite intimidated in this academic surrounding, both on the panel and in the audience, and all the more so as one of our discussants, Professor Nerling, has, of course, much better than I did prepared the field by for what I feel will be his next attack on EMU. The reasons, well, there are reasons pro and con, and they are as plentiful as blackberries. I would like to limit myself to just four remarks, three on EMU and four and one on Britain in particular. My first point is there may be some news to that I can bring to the audience, some news from the continent, and it is in my according to my experience that resistance in Germany against EMU is tapering off. There is still the fidelity vis-à-vis the Deutschmark, and there is still some no love affair with the euro, but people are getting ready for the event. If I trace it down to any other, to a certain reason, then it would certainly be the Madrid European Council, who baptized the product, gave it the name euro. In this country, more linked to skepticism. In my country, it is quite an acceptable term. It also established a timetable stretching out over 5 to 6 years, and so there is a degree of certainty, and people are getting ready. And that is a certain desirable degree of realism in the discussion, because after all, we are law-abiding people, and we have a treaty that has been signed and ratified and approved by the Constitutional Court, so we should actually get ready. Second point, there is, of course, something that has not changed on our mind and on our approach to EMU, and that is stability matters most. And that is why we keep a close eye on convergence and convergence criteria, and convergence takes precedence over the timetable. That is very important, but it need not necessarily be a contradiction. Progress on the criteria is quite good on some criteria. We shouldn't overlook this and nor neglect this. A certain stability culture is already in the making all over Europe, and that is a good basis for EMU. But of course, to be sure that as far as the criteria, the fiscal criteria are concerned, a lot of things need to be done. And my government, which has missed the deficit criterion last year, will miss it this year again, endeavors to do everything to meet it next year by the tune of 2.5 to 3%. And we don't see a contradiction, Professor Nerling, between savings and overhaul of our welfare system and the fight against unemployment. The old recipes of the Keynesian times are no longer valid, and reducing the government sector, government share in the economy is probably the best we can do to generate more jobs. My third point is, if we have to wait for convergence so as to enter into EMU, we don't have to wait for a full-fledged political union. That is maybe an important point in a country where Germans are generally seen as federalists, as European federalists. We don't need political union for the system, for the EMU to work satisfactorily. You know EMU what it means. It means economic and monetary union. You have a built-in policy mix between a centralized monetary authority at the European level and national fiscal policies who remain under national sovereignty and who are being coordinated by the way of the fiscal criteria. And Minister Weigel's proposal for a European Stability Pact is there to strengthen this part of the two pillars. In any event, we don't need, in our view, a gouvernement économique as it has been proposed by Jacques Delors in his times. It would only try to organize further transfers and increase the imbalance between net contributors and net beneficiaries from the EU budget. My last point now, Britain, on all accounts and from our German perspective, official German perspective, should be part of EMU and should also be part of ERM, not because we favor an extension of the Brussels Empire, not because we favor any imperialism of that kind, but because we need Britain as a partner in the economic and monetary discussion and debate in the European Union and in EMU and in the European Central Bank. We need it as a partner whose economic philosophy we share very largely, and we want to work with a partner who, just as we, as our approach is, works with the grain of the market, and that is something that we still see lacking in other bureaucracies on the continent. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much. Just before passing on to Thomas Kielinger, can I just ask you one question regarding the stability taking precedence over the timetable? Does that mean that if the convergence criteria were to be overshot, say, for debts or deficits, just by a few percentage points, or a few decimal places, would that be a sufficient reason for delaying, as theoretically?
Well, I was expecting that question. It is a question that cannot be answered, certainly not by me, certainly not by anybody right now. The decision has to be made ex post at the beginning of 1998, actually under the British presidency, and the criteria have actually reflect a historical performance of a certain amount of time, and that has to be seen in early 1998.
Okay. Well, I'm sure beef will be on the menu for the dinner where they decide that. Thomas Kielinger, you tend to look at this from a more political, sociological standpoint. How do you see this from the point of view of sanitizing Germany after the end of the Cold War?
Well, you're a right old beta, David, by coming up with the word sanitizing. Let me first of all say how pleased I am that I sneaked into Britain on Sunday this week, before this latest war broke out. I'm not sure I would have been admitted under the terms of the headlines of the press in this country. So I'm okay for now. I'll see what happens when I try to leave, if my credentials are still intact. But be that as it may, I'm very pleased to hear so much optimism on my right. I think optimism is important, but when you look at economic monetary union, a lot of that optimism is built on assumptions that remain to be proven. It's built on projections that I'm sure we cannot be certain about in the first place. And that strikes me as being rather culturally funny, because Germany is a society that, which you know, likes to debate issues for years and years, because we feel that 8 million people need to be in the debating club. They all need to voice their fears, their concerns, and their arguments. And this time around, with monetary union, which was the most fateful decision and important one in the history of post-war economic Europe, should be taken in a hurry and should not be allowed the airing of the viewpoints for the same amount of time, say, that we have invested in a smaller problem like opening our shops for an hour and a half more in the evenings. That has taken us 35 years to deliberate, and if you equate the seriousness of subject matters by the time the German populace takes to debate them, surely shop opening hours is far more important, obviously, than EMU, because we can take care of EMU and dispose of it within a couple of years. I mustn't be cynical. I'm sure my optimism is directed at the hope that we won't qualify a year or so from now, And that's just all to the good, because if we go ahead with the plan as scheduled, we will be entering into monetary union at the worst possible time in the economic history of my country and the economic history of many another country in Europe that wants to be a member or should be a member of this union. Why is it the bad time? Well, we have structural problems staring us in the face, which are enormously big and quite outside EMU to look at and to solve just off our own bat. If we go into monetary union without having tackled our homework, without having looked at unemployment, without having looked at the social system in Germany, without having looked and begun to reduce this huge entitlement mentality which besets the economic prospects of Germany and has made our country so uncompetitive, I fear that we're simply going to translate our problems into a wider Europe, find ourselves with all our hopes dashed, and find ourselves too with a Chancellor who may have overpromised what economic monetary union could do to help us. We will then have a situation where we blame Europe and the regime of monetary union for the things that we have been unable to solve beforehand. I will leave it at this and discuss the details and see them discussed later. One final point is that I'm a little bit apprehensive about the political argument used. Most of the argument has been on the need for the political union that should come after, and that Germany should be a country politically tied. I feel Germany has been politically tied in Europe very beautifully for the last decades. In fact, we already have a currency union in Europe. We have a common coinage, and the common coinage to that which Germany belongs to is the rule of law, due process, human rights, and democratic rights of all. I think Germany's done splendidly, and we have come a long way in Europe to rebuild a prosperous community of nations. I fear we will jeopardize far too much of the Europe we have achieved, and beginning to enter into a phase of scapegoating, mutual recrimination, an inability to tackle this huge equalization regime which will ensue when we go into a common currency and look at trying to balance out all the ills and other problems. So I would say hold off, look at the problems we have at home, try and show to the world the German economy can revive its competitiveness by being courageously inclined and intent on finally breaking the mold of the way Germans have been doing business so far. I'm saying, as my last word, we're not going to see any of the problems starting with unemployment solved on the European level, and Germany would do well to first put her own house in order before she enters the monetary union at the wrong time. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, this is developing a bit like a football match, and in fact it's very good that the British authorities have set up this new football spectacle called the Euro, simply as part of the way of publicising the new currency, because there's been an early goal by the pro-Euros, and I think it's a bit like the World Cup final in 1966, where the defensive team has hit back now. Now I'd like to pass on to Dr. Bob.
We'll leave the doctor out, please. Thank you, David. As David said, these are dangerous times to be in Britain, and whether you're a beef eater or not a beef eater, even for a German who's been here sort of 26 years and has been 26 years in Germany. Therefore, and because I'm a cautious businessman, I'm going to offer a view, a German businessman's view on Europe, and that's basically from the German perspective. But then in the second part, I want to put my British hat on, nearly a new British hat, and talk about what I think the British position is. Let me start by reminding us maybe that business and commerce has very often led, actually, politicians and unifications. The Deutsche Zollverein, the Norddeutsche Zollverein, North German Custom Union preceded the 1871 reunification, the first reunification of Germany. Basically, the Industrial Revolution had started and companies were growing. They needed larger markets and they needed more stability around them and around themselves, and that's how that happened. When you look at the post-war history, a similar thing happened. Like many European companies, my own company, Jung Heinrich, was first a regional North German company after the war, and then it developed into a national company. and that was during the 50s and 60s, and during the 70s and 80s, it developed into a European company with a dozen subsidiaries in all these countries. The single market was only created, you know, sort of with a time lag from our perspective of about 10 to 15 years. So the politicians were really following it, and even now, we still haven't in Europe a common currency, one single currency for us all. And what it means for business is the following. Last year, the company that we acquired, a manufacturer, Boss, lost just short of £1 million on the foreign exchanges in losses, because we assumed wrongly that we didn't need to cover ourselves, and the pound plunged from about 242, which we planned at, to something like 218 at the lowest point. If you cover yourself forward, you incur losses as well, because you have to pay quite heavy charges when you buy material over a 12-month period. And these amounts, when you top them up over a period, in our company, amount to about £50 million over this period of time. So I think there's a good reason for asking for stability. One could argue, of course, that business is now leaving the European scene behind, and why should we have a common currency in Europe? Because we're now moving from being a European company to a global company, and there are some people who are saying, we don't need that anymore. You know, the time has passed Europe. But I don't really agree with that, because European companies are in a fight to the death in many ways, involved with competition from companies in very large markets like the United States with 250 million people, with Japan. They've got very large, stable markets around themselves, and they are in competition with all the low currency markets in the world. And these companies in these countries, they basically rely on a very low exchange rate, because that is the average performance of that country. But these countries have got industrial policies that basically champion certain industries. And in these industries, they attack very successful. And they have got a productivity in these particular industries that is not matched by the exchange rate. And therefore, they make real money in those, and they attack markets like cars, electronics. They've done this over many, many years. And I think one can call it industrial policy. One could also call it cheating. So I think it is something that we need to be aware of. I would prefer, and I think every German manufacturer would prefer, and European manufacturer would prefer, to have a stability in a home market of 250 or 300 million people in Europe, where we can conduct 80% of our business. That is basically your home business in your own country and that of your surrounding companies. For Germany, that would be over 80% basically of its, or 75 to 80% of its total trade. And to have stability there and then attack from that base the rest of the UK would make a lot of sense. With regard to the point of being worried about or this paranoid view about prices going up following the single currency, I think you should look at the possibilities of all the money that we can save by reducing cost. The 50 million that I've talked about would have made our trucks cheaper. That's only one tiny little company in Europe. You can multiply that by 1,000 or 1,000,000, and that makes a real difference. So I think there will be pressures for prices to come down. On top of that, we don't live in an inflation world anymore. We live now in a time of deflationary pressures, which are higher than the inflationary pressures. And therefore, I think we shouldn't over-exaggerate that. The price is too high to lose. I think we have got, if inflation goes to 5 or 6% for a period of time, we had that before, we cope with it, we got it under control again. So what? From Britain's point of view, I think the situation looks quite different. When I came here, the pound was 11 marks 20. And now it is it was 218, 220. It's now suddenly gone up by miraculously to 232, not because any fundamentals have changed, but only because interest rate expectations in Germany are down and interest expectations in Britain are up. And therefore, suddenly, British exporters have to pay 6% more, 6% more costly, and imports have come down 6% in price. And Britain has already, with Germany, a trade deficit last year of nearly 20 billion Deutschmarks. So So I think where that is going to lead. So I think Britain can do with stability in this area too. But there is a danger, of course, for Britain, because the monetary and fiscal conversion criteria is only one part of the story for Britain. The real story for Britain is what I would call systems and performance conversion. By performance conversion, we're talking about productivity, investment levels, skill levels, infrastructure levels, and all these things where I think we've got structural weaknesses in the UK. But in systems convergence, I mean something else, and that is that British companies are forced to take a very much shorter view on business, short-term profits. We are living off, you know, sort of companies grow by acquisition and then downsize rather by organic growth, etc. These are systems weaknesses, and I think until they are addressed, it is dangerous for Britain to go into the market. Maybe the next government might want to change some of these systems deficiencies, and therefore there's maybe a chance to enter EMU for Britain in the sort of second half of the second term of the next government.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Michael Stürmer, you also look at this question in terms of systems, I think, but you also look at it in terms of the ending of the bipolar system at the end of the 1980s. Is monetary union in a way a product of that ending of the Cold War, and is it the right way to address all the new uncertainties that we face?
It is a reaction to the ending of the bipolar system. It is a reaction to a German unification. The Germans had the feeling, and the French had the feeling too, that the Germans owe the French something. And there was also the feeling that by adding the GDR to the Federal Republic, there would be a new giant in the heart of Europe, and somehow you had to avoid the old problem of hegemony and balance, and so the answer was found in integration. The problem was, the French meant they wanted to get back sovereignty, which they had forced to give to the Bundesbank, while the Germans wanted to transfer that sovereignty to a supranational authority, on the one hand the future Eurobank, on the other hand the future political union. And so this resulted in the two intergovernmental conferences. And if you look at the Maastricht Treaty, which is really the result with two parts of the Intergovernmental Conference of 1990-1991, you find a very detailed and fat dossier on EMU with a calendar and criteria and all the acquis communautaire, and you find a very tormented, difficult, contradictory, vague dossier on political union. Although in the beginning there was unanimity in Germany, led by the Chancellor, that we would not sacrifice the Deutschmark if we would not get assurances that in future policies there would be a policy fusion. We were not very clear how we wanted it, but certainly the until 1990, the system of running the, or managing, it's not a government, managing the European Union was not very convincing for anything but foreign commerce and agriculture. Agricultural market, sort of market distortion, because it's no market. It's called the Common Agricultural Policy. Now, that was the political beginning. Once again, you had economic means to political ends. Just like the European Union Economic Community had originated in 1956, 1957, 1958. There are now, of course, many problems, and to look at the whole situation only in terms of the convergence in 1997 and the technical fixes is technocratic and too narrow. If you have still in Germany 70% of the people who, when asked, say, we don't really have much confidence in the euro, not very many people have tried to explain it, and it's difficult to explain, it's difficult to show. You don't even know how the thing looks, will look like, and you of course have to reassure people, not because they are greedy, but because the currency of a country is a very, very important part of people's identity, of their pride, their self-respect, and their assurance that one day they will not wake up with the Greek drachma in their hands instead of the tough Deutschmark. And of course, that's a nightmare for people who don't trust politicians and who don't trust the state too much as being good Democrats. They trust themselves more than other people. So there are two. I would just, from the many problems, I would select two. One is there is still not a policy framework in sight for the common currency. And that is still the most difficult deficit compared to the starting situation in 1991. The Europeans have not delivered, and the Germans were not quite sure what they wanted, because it's really very complicated. So we are on the policy side. The nation states, including Germany, are more autistic than ever before. Even Germany, the model student of the European class, is not a model performer in all the single market issue. We have got a number of admonitions, which are serious. Now the theory has been reversed, and the theory is now, once you have economic and monetary union, this will force the participants, the so-called ins, into developing joint policies. And that's the second problem. You now have the ins and the outs. The problem for the Bundesbank at present and for everybody is now to sort of reinvent a kind of new EMS between the future fused currency, the common currency, and the other EU members who are not part of it, and some, like, it's not a secret, like Greece, will not soon join the system. That is not only an economic problem, it's a very big political problem, because if you start from the assumption that EMU will develop and has to, in order to function, has to develop its own informal rounds, its informal management system, you're talking about a very effective system based on a common bank, based on a lot of things that have to be put together, fused, or the pieces will fly. And you are talking about a system which in no way can be fit into the system that has grown over 40 years and is not a mathematician's dream, but it's rather a very difficult, very complex labyrinth of complexities which are often now cut short through informal working groups. So we are facing two very closely related political problems, and we are facing this, and I'll end with this, in a time where the Germans are still in the middle of this enormous challenge, larger than any challenge any Western country has faced for the last 50 years, called unification. It's still a big problem. Second, the German welfare state still has to shed a lot of fat, and that is a very painful and cruel process. Add to this the yo-yo of the dollar. If the dollar is at 170, we'll all be happy and we'll march happily singing anthems into EMU. And there's no question, but the dollar may not be at 170. Deutschmark. And finally, we are all suffering under the cruel impact, unrelenting, unforgiving impact of globalization. And we've only seen so far in Germany, we've only seen the first part of it. But there is much more to come. And it will be an unforgiving process. So the pain will probably grow, and that's why we should all be grateful for the optimism we can still muster.
Well, thank you, Michael. Just before passing to Wilhelm Lilling, you are in the advisory business, and you're also used to providing executive summaries. If you had to do a one-paragraph piece of advice for Chancellor Kohl, or even better, if you were the German Chancellor, which from time to time I'm sure you imagine you are, in relation to all the dilemmas of EMU, what would you do very quickly?
Well, first of all, let me say, I decide over my own dreams. I would say it is, and I would repeat this, it has been said by Schäuble, who after all is the number two in terms of power in Germany, by Tietmeyer, who is also quite a well-known character. It is not the end of the world if we try to form a larger group than just those who
may or may not qualify just about with a little stretching. It will not be the end of the world. Second, the government has to make a huge effort to prove to the people that it's good against unemployment, good for growth, and that is a difficult task.
Thank you. Wilhelm Lilling, you have been talking about this for quite a lot this week. How do you think we can take a constructive view of the way forward on European Monetary Union?
Ladies and gentlemen, we should be under no illusions. The present controversy over the new monetary order in Europe is about power, influence, and the pursuit of national interests. See the article by Anatole Kaletsky in today's Times. The European approach of the Maastricht Treaty to monetary policy was bound to create tensions and illusions. Tensions because of the built-in antagonism of a fixed timetable on the one hand and the need of a still highly diversified Europe of 12 and now 15 members to become more homogeneous on the other, to converge in monetary and real terms in an incredibly short period of time, to make the truly gigantic task of transforming Europe's monetary order a lasting success. It has become clear by now that one of the two ambitious goals have got to give way. Since Europe's dilemma is not primarily a monetary one, but a real one in terms of an incessant increase in mass unemployment and an unstoppable rise in public debt everywhere, whereby the most crucial convergence criteria are being violated, the task now before us, before European politicians, is to ask what the preparation and the implementation of EMU is doing to improve or to worsen the present and the foreseeable situation in Europe. I think that in the face of low growth or no growth at all, or a recession underway in Germany right now, and low growth expectations for years to come, in the face of unsolved legal, conceptual, and a host of technical problems, not least the dramatically high costs of conversion, EMU has become a burden, a brake, an engine of deflation, and a main promoter of an economically unhealthy high degree of uncertainty, at least in Germany. As one of the first critics, I proposed a delay, a shelving, a postponement when I opened the first Fleming European lecture in June of last year. Since then, the need to do so has become more obvious. In the meantime, my position, I advanced in the summer, as I said, has been supported by the Sachverständigenrat in Germany in the fall of 1995, and among others, most recently, by the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Willem Kok. Removing the nightmare, or I would like to call it straitjacket, of EMU from Europe's most pressing agenda items would free our politicians and institutions to turn to the real problems. By this I mean to bring their own houses in order, and as we have heard, there's a lot to be done,
where there is no excuse of blaming it to others. There is a lot to be done, and it cannot be done by others. The idea or vision of a monetary union should not be abandoned at all. It should get a second try when Europe does not have to start it from economic weakness, but from a position of economic, social, and political strength, expecting a more promising future than is in sight now. Until then, the presently working institutions like the European Monetary System and the European Monetary Institute can and will see to it that Europe gets the monetary guidance it needs in order to further the process of convergence in Europe everywhere. Again, I would like to float my idea of Europeanizing the Bundesbank in order to be constructive, in a sense, to let other countries share its power as long as a truly European central bank does not seem to be possible. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. We can go back into that idea of Europeanizing the Bundesbank a little bit later on. There are a fascinating number of technical and political questions here which have all been aired, and it would be perhaps beyond the bounds of our evening to explore them all, but we do seem to have isolated one very central question which I'd like to ask Michael Huska to address straight away, the convergence criteria. There is a view put very powerfully by Wilhelm Nilling that not only are the criteria at the moment impossible to fulfill, but even the act of trying to fulfill them is deflationary, is exacerbating unemployment. There is another view, I know, which is taken by the German government, that if we did not have those criteria and if we relaxed the timetable for monetary union, everything would get even worse. Now, in fact, objectively, Europe has not done very well on convergence on the debt and the deficit level since 1990. Do you think, Michael Huska, if there were to be a delay in the EMU starting date, that everything would actually get still worse?
I do think so, but I would like to just to go back to these to the point you made at the beginning, and actually I realize how appropriately you have placed Mr. Kielinger close to Professor Nölling, because he as well, he said it was the wrong time. It was the wrong time. EMU is good, but it's the wrong time. And precisely yes. This because of the criteria. Now, I do think that this is the precisely the entirely wrong perspective. Because, from our own experience, we all know that the time is never good to undertake efforts and new efforts. But then also, with respect to EMU, no responsible person in Germany would deny that we have problems. That something is rotten in the state of D-Mark. That's certainly true. But nobody says yes. Either we do it as a sacrifice for Maastricht. We do it to remove strangling conditions to the German economy. We do it to make Germany a competitive place to work and to invest in. We have to do it anyway. And we have to do it is by reducing budget deficits and by reducing the social security deficits. So that we really don't have any choice. If we advocated now to wait, then that would be a recipe or a prescription for failure. Nothing is as attractive as the status quo. And whoever argues in favor of postponement basically argues for the status quo. And that will never bring us any step further towards EMU nor to a closer organized Europe.
Okay, could I just ask Bob Bischoff to make a comment from an industrialist point of view on that question of deflation? I mean, Wilhelm Dönig has raised the spectre of deflation. It may not be because of Maastricht at all. It may be because of some other reason, but we are going into a low-growth phase. It may well be exacerbated by countries trying to meet these criteria. Seen from a point of view of somebody who's selling forklift truck around Europe, does this worry you that people are all trying to cut their deficits together, or is it in fact a good thing because they've finally realized that they have to do this?
I think it is a good thing that it is that this question is addressed, but I think it is also a secondary question. I think what is happening in Europe is this whole debate is exactly what was said here a second ago. Europe likes the status quo. We've lost our dynamics totally. When you look at the Asian Tiger countries, they're showing us how to move forward. Everything here is status quo. We are 15 years, the politicians are 15 years behind business. 15 years ago we could have done with a common currency in Europe and we would have been a lot stronger. Unemployment will come down when we trade more with each other and not when we've got barriers everywhere and every little company is afraid of crossing borders. And I think the way forward is not to be afraid of this step but to go forward now, not in 15 years' time. By that time we're talking global economy anyway, and I think events will have overturned this totally, overtaken it.
Thomas Kielinger, you said that we've been talking about shopping hours in Germany for 35 years, but you also said we must wait until Germany has reformed itself. Only then can we go through to EMU. Aren't we going to wait rather a long time?
I'm glad you've raised this point, because I'm not. I don't think the point was made here to my right that we are. That I'm advocating status quo is right at all. On the contrary, I'm very pleased to see that my country is beginning actually to revamp its system and the way it's been doing business at home for the first time in many, many years. I'm very pleased to see the Chancellor finally investing his substantial prestige to knock special interests in my country and remind the German population that something needs to give and the belt needs to be tightened. We can no longer continue to afford this cloud cuckoo economy whereby people work up to about 9 months a year and expect something like 13 and a half months salary for it. And this is impossible to sustain. I'm an impatient person by nature. I'm not advocating status quo. I think we're heading in the right direction. I'm also not sure that what Mr. Bischoff said is right, that companies are afraid to cross borders. The problem is exactly the opposite. German companies have been very pleased to cross borders, both with their capital and with their plant. We have created jobs to the hundreds of thousands dash outside Germany in cheaper locations. We are investing in Britain to a staggering degree. Between 1994 and 1995, German capital has leapt from 3.5 billion Deutschmark investment in 1994 in this country to 10.6 billion here. So we have discovered the attractiveness of Britain as a place to which to invest. So I think we would, from that example, take a leaf out of the book of your country, having tried to revitalize your economic fortunes. I know that you haven't done sufficiently well, but you've done better than we have, for example, in unemployment, and at least you have prepared the population for sacrifices to be made. I'm saying again, it would be a pity if we blame Europe when we go into the Union too soon for some of the things we haven't yet solved sufficiently well in our own backyard. And the Chancellor has, unfortunately, and some of our economic experts, sold economic union as a panacea for the problems we have yet to do. But I'm not advocating status quo at all, nor am I saying that companies want to stay put. They're actually emigrating, relocating to cheaper markets. And that is a problem I face. I don't think the European Monetary Union is going to solve that in and of itself.
Michael Stürmer, I'd like to widen the question out of France. President Chirac, when he's been selling these latest rather harsh austerity measures, he does in fact say we need to do this because of France. We don't need to do this just because of Maastricht. Now, it's clear that Germany and France need to be in monetary union in order to make it work, in order to even have a monetary union. Do you think there's sufficient will in France to go ahead with these strict policies, even though there is the danger, as everybody knows, of a postponement? Could it be that the crock of euro at the end of the rainbow will not be there for President Chirac?
I think that the political class in France is absolutely firm in their will to go ahead with EMU. They've invested so much prestige. And they've also been wise enough last November and December, when the streets of Paris were full of protesters, not to say we do it pour les beaux yeux des Allemands, but we do it for our own sake. Now, there is, of course, a problem in all our countries. I'm not an economist, but it's obvious to see. We are trying to generate growth, and at the same time, we are taking away purchasing power in many, many ways. The government, the German government, expects industry to create jobs while it slashes jobs on a very large scale, and has to. So there are many contradictions in the present situation. I think you can argue, you can make good, very good technical and economic arguments for EMU and much less good arguments against. The real problems are political. European countries are drifting further apart as a result of the end of the Cold War, and EMU will not force their policies there. It will force some of their policies together, at least of the ins, but perhaps not of the outs. At present, Europe has, and the attention span of parliaments and politicians and bureaucrats is limited, and they cannot tackle 3, 4, 5, 6 major problems. At present, we have at the Intergovernmental Conference to tackle the problem of the management of Europe, the governance of Europe. We have to tackle the problem of a common foreign and security policy. The Dayton Agreement will expire in half a year's time, and it's either a bloodbath or a European solution. But there is no European solution in place, not on the civilian side, not on the military side. On the civilian side, the Europeans have done much more than the Americans, but on the military side, without the Americans, so far, we face a leadership vacuum. Then, of course, you have the problem of Eastern widening, which is not only a question of being nice to the Poles. It's a very big question of the reallocation of European funds. Common agricultural policy will have to be thought through, and there has to be an agonizing reappraisal of common agricultural policy. The structural funds, which now go largely to Ireland and the South, the regional funds, same direction. They will have to be shared, and sharing welfare, cutting your own welfare and sharing it with others, is a painful process. So the European agenda has very major political items in front of it, and I'm afraid that at present we are not moving in those fields which are closer to my daily business. We are not moving fast enough in these matters because their time is working against us.
I'd like to address this question, really, of the imbalance. You pointed out imbalances between the wider field and what's happening in monetary union. Wilhelm Lilling, you have pointed out the imbalance between the fiscal side of policy after monetary union, which continues to be carried out by the individual states, and the immense power of the central bank. I'd like you to say how you think that could be rectified. I'd also like you to home in on this question of the Constitutional Court. You have said that you would be prepared, with others who remain nameless, to go to the Constitutional Court, rather like Luther, I imagine, banging on the door or nailing a thesis to the door at Worms. Could you talk about the central bank and also about the Constitutional Court?
Please permit me to say a word to preserving a status quo in general. I don't think it makes much sense to be in favor of changing for the sake of changing. Though you would probably agree with me that there are situations I would not like to see changed at all. And there are others we need to change. I think we agree on this principal question. If my former colleagues would have listened to me, again, digging up an old idea of mine they don't like at all, they would have told Mr. Ruskow that this fellow is really in favor of changing the status quo of the Bundesbank. And I think that is a good answer. I mean, an institutional improvement over the present situation, and for some time, certainly a good substitute for the non-existing European Central Bank. Permit me to say only very few words with regard to Mr. Ruskow's contention that Keynes is out. Keynes was in, discredited what the politicians did following him, so he is out for good and forever. I strongly dispute this. And my problem right now, finding out what the new program of the government means in terms of influencing positively the economic development of Germany is, and here it comes back to the question how the economy is going to perform. My problem is that this is an almost entire 92% or even more supply side thing. And not paying enough attention in such a crucial situation to demand aspects, I think, is a very, very bad error on the mission.
How is the new central bank going to help
saying,
in all that?
What I'm saying, David, what I'm saying is, here the London School of Economics, I understand, in earlier years, was certainly in many respects and by many professors following Keynesian thinking. And to discard all of what he has said so simply that that it's not important anymore. We will see what this program of supply side economics in Germany is going to do to the prospects of reaching the criteria. So I wanted to make this very clear. Being a dyed-in-the-wool Keynesian, mm-hmm. after all, I admit it very freely. Now. Just to say, to answer this question with regard to fiscal and monetary policy mix, isn't it interesting that the boss of Mr. Ruskow, in a debate in the Bundestag in 1991, was very proud to announce that the fiscal criteria established by the Maastricht Treaty were fully sufficient. There would never be any problem with regard to influencing of the core union by irresponsible fiscal behavior on part of sovereign states. All of a sudden, in 1995, he changed his mind. He realized that a stability pact was needed because Maastricht criteria would not suffice. It's very interesting. And the stability pact, I don't think it's working. It's going to work. If it's going to get put into effect, it needs to be put into effect along the lines of the requirements of the Maastricht Treaty.
Okay, well, let's take that point about the Stability Pact, because I'd like us to actually home in on that point, Wilhelm.
Just one figure. One figure, right. If it were in effect, the Stability Pact proposed, Mr. Ruskow would know better than we all that it would amount to 9 billion German marks in penalty deposits to the European Central Bank, 9 billion marks. That would be the consequence right now at the time when the government
Can we ask Mr. Ruskow about the stability pact? This is a very important part of the whole fiscal monetary mix. First of all, is the fiscal policy going to be run by some sort of supranational body? Clearly not. Are there going to be automatic mechanisms for regulating deficits throughout the community with fines?
Well, in the first place, I think the fiscal criteria may embody whatever people may think, but they certainly don't embody a Keynesian approach. The basic idea is to have sound public finances and not to leave leeway for the government and for the public sector to become something like employer or provider of demand of last resort. That is certainly the philosophy behind the fiscal criteria. With all due respect to the Keynesians, and I have lived through the...
No, don't show any respect. Just go ahead.
I remember the period. Now, the Stability Pact. The Stability Pact is by no means a new... over and beyond the treaty. It is already, rests on all the elements that are already in the treaty. In the treaty you have a sanctioning procedure if the deficit criteria are not met, the sanctions include interest-free deposits, and then also even in the end of it, fines. And the only approach, or the basic approach of Mr. Weigel's proposal, is to make this more operational, not to have it as nice basic principles in the treaty, and leave it then to the discussions about decisions in the ECOFIN Council, but to make it clear from the outset that whoever goes beyond the 3% has to runs the risk of having a given fine, which may be debated and defined beforehand, but it has to be defined beforehand and may not be left to politicking in the ECOFINRAT once the situation has already arisen.
But somebody, some people do interpret the emphasis on the stability pact, which is, after all, a new word, as almost a substitute for the fact that the criteria are not going to be very rigorously regarded in the first year of monetary union, and therefore you need some mechanism thereafter. Is it really a substitute for the fact that the criteria are not really going to come into effect, as Mr. Weigel and Mr. Cole said they were going to, that they're going to be treated in a slightly liberal, more generous fashion?
I don't think so, but one thing is true, it is a different situation. When we talk about the criteria in the startup of the of EMU, then we have no stability pact as yet. And the stability pact is basically focusing on the situation once countries have joined EMU. And so the situation is slightly different. I don't see a trade-off there. But it is certainly one element to strengthen the respect of the criteria once EMU has started, and it is certainly also something that very much appeals to the German public and all those who attach importance to a stable currency. We don't need a single currency, but it must be a stable currency.
And is it going to happen, the Stability Pact?
When is it going to happen? Well, the discussions are underway in the ECOFIN Council.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, the Stability Pact idea floated by the German finance minister, of course, appealed very much to the German public, especially that part of the German public, which really thinks the stable money is a very important thing. Others think that high employment is a very important thing. The Germans have three nightmares. One is inflation. They've had enough of that. The other one is mass unemployment. And the third one is the consequence of the two in the 1930s, to be alone, to be isolated, to be the enemy of the world. So these three nightmares work against each other. We have not only two souls in our breast like Faust. We always had two souls, everybody probably has, but we have three souls. And I must say, with due respect, David, if you allow me to say so, the Stability Pact to me, in the real world, where people go on the streets for very, very small things. Now, if you look at the things, we have big strikes threatening now in Germany. Everybody knows these things have to go. It's a lot of fat, and if they don't go, the system will just fall apart, and everybody knows this. And now people take to the streets, and there is great bitterness with ÖTV, the transport workers and the public workers, and with IG Metall, the most important, biggest European Union, for very minor things. And the cruelties in if a country has to exceed, sort of has to speed over the speed limit of 3%, the cruelties in the fines are enormous. And I don't really see that a country will muster that kind of self-discipline which is then needed, and the kind of leadership which is then needed. I think that the Stability Pact, if it had been invented around the table of a faculty club with professors, it would be called, from the realists, a professorial idea. I cannot see it working in the real world.
The word leadership has come up, Thomas Keeling. I mean, who is going to lead Europe? Is it going to be the Stability Pact? Is it going to be the monetary technocrats? Is it going to be the professors? Or is it somebody like Helmut Kohl? We have been told that this is a very political project, as well, of course, as an economic one. Much does depend on Helmut Kohl. What do you think he really wants from the euro?
Helmut Kohl's leadership I wage is in the eye of the beholder. I know I shouldn't be saying that. I may not be readmitted into Germany for having just said that, because everyone universally thinks he's such a great leader. I think he's leading the country because of angst that he represents, angst about future wars, and maybe angst for the destabilization of Germany once he's left the stage. Every politician thinks that his country is going broke once he leaves the stage. That's in the nature of the super egos that you create when you let someone govern for 14 years. I'm glad this country caught her as supreme leader after only 11. That was probably the last chance you could have got her. We missed our opportunity because largely those people who came out to plot to get the Chancellor lost their dagger on the way to the forum.
That's
and
right.
Time and again he stood tall and just dispensed with the ineptness of these plotters, these gunpowder plotters, Manquet. Mm. So, come back to your serious question, leader. I do feel our Chancellor is using wrong leadership rhetoric. He wants to sacrifice Germany on the altar of our democratic credentials. He says in order for Germany to pass that litmus test, we need to be shown to give up our currency, actually weaken it. And we've heard the business argument too. The business argument is all in favor of weakening the currency to enable exports to boom. I think that's the leadership from the negative. I'd much rather wish I could see a leadership which first controls the evil forces of our own society and bucks these influences that want to make it impossible for Germany to become competitive again. Because as I said before, and I tend to repeat myself, the longer this discussion goes on, we cannot expect, and you haven't given us one good reason to believe, unemployment will be reduced, that structural deficit will come down once we have EMU. My fear is, and we should really be discussing this, that once we have this regime of unitary currency, there will be enormous amount of pressure for equalization of conditions throughout the community. And for that to happen, we shall see new regimes of transfer payments. We shall see perhaps countries who would perhaps build fences around this new pressure, like Germany, and resist this pressure and then build up subsidy fences around them.
Well, I would like to go back to this guy in a moment on that point. I'd also like to open this to the floor sooner or later. But before that, I'd like to ask Wilhelm the question I asked you before, which you either declined to answer, or maybe it was my fault for not allowing you enough time, the question of delay and the Constitutional Court. Now, this is also a question of leadership, because if the Constitutional Court were to decide that your objections or anybody else's objections about the criteria were valid, then this would put out of action the political leadership on EMU. It would actually put this thing into abeyance for some time. Can I really ask you very, very directly, under what conditions would you in 1998, perhaps, go to the Constitutional Court?
There is a suspicion that people, and please forgive me for including you now, who say that the convergence criteria fulfillment will take precedence over the timetable pay lip service. I'm really excluding Mr. Rusko because he qualified it, but. And for this reason, I feel that Mr. Kohl is up to get his way regardless and to become the architect of a monetary union. So when we sense this and so on, and then I believe we should tell him very early that there is a ruling by the Constitutional Court. And this ruling makes clear that only a rigid, very strenuous, in a very strenuous fashion taking place evaluation is compatible with our Constitution. It's exactly 47 years today that this Constitution went into effect. And the Germans giving up the D-Mark because the court declared it constitutional would like to rely on the Constitutional Court again in case the government tramples over the criteria and interprets them leniently. That's the reason why I felt one should make clear that politicians who want to go ahead should please heed what the Constitutional Court said and what the Constitutional Court is going to do in case the situation develops as I am afraid of.
Mr. Ruska, I mean, this is a point which obviously you should provide an answer to as well.
Well, it is sure that the Constitutional Court has made a precondition in interpreting the treaty that the monetary union is only constitutional to the extent it embodies a community of stability, as it was put, a stability community. And of course, I think all the preconditions are set that EMU can earn this qualification. Mind you, the often quoted fear of a kind of dilution of the criteria is maybe less than one might think. If you look at the procedural side of it, then the decision that will be made, as I said, under UK presidency in early 1998, will not just be made out of thin air and after political debate. It will rest on a report, well, both by the Commission and by the European Monetary Institute. The European Monetary Institute will give an opinion on whether the countries are ready for EMU, having due regard to the criteria. It will deliver an economically well-founded opinion, and it will then be extremely difficult, Professor Nulling, it will be extremely difficult for politicians to tinker about those qualifications, in particular in a year when you have in Germany and also in France general elections. If Chancellor Kohl tried to go to the public and win the elections, and have on his record the mere attempt to have changed, to have moved away from stability, then I think his chances to stand the elections wouldn't be very good.
So you basically agree with Professor Nulling, do you? Is this a very useful clarifying of the atmosphere, or is it a bit of an irritation?
Well, I wouldn't go to the court. The court has.
I wouldn't expect you
taken
to go.
Care. And I wouldn't advise. Mr. Nulling is going to lose a lot of money in legal fees, but of course.
You think he's going to lose? I don't want to get too hung up on these convergence criteria, but they do seem to be pretty important. What, you know, these wretched criteria. Before passing on.
Wretched or rigid?
Richard, but pass it before going on to the floor. Bob Bischoff, I mean, from your point of view, you've spoken about industry, you've spoken about social affairs, you've spoken about systems. Are we getting too hung up on these convergence criteria? Shouldn't we just go ahead anyway? If we need a single market and a single currency, industrialists want stability of currency. Shouldn't we really just not pay too much attention to these figures? Nobody seems to know who invented them anyway.
I would appeal particularly for the young people here not to listen to bankers, politicians, and journalists. And here we've got a double distrust person here. He was a journalist, a banker now, and I think...
Well, not a politician there.
Banker, politicians, and journalists. And I think we can... This whole subject, I think, can be talked to death. And I think, you know, as I said before, business has led in this way. It has... we are crossing all these borders. You know, countries that have got a strong manufacturing culture, like Germany, is dominated by manufacturers, fortunately. They want stability. And because they want stability, I think in the end they're going to get it. Britain, on the other hand, is a financially dominated country, as we all know. Our city is very important here. And even in government, the most important ministry is the Treasury. And not.
I like the way you say our city, though, Bob. Doesn't that mean you've been sort of taken over by them yourself?
I've got the British hat on now. So I think in Britain it will be very different, because financial institutions don't necessarily want stability, because they live off the ups and downs, yeah, because of the stock market or on the foreign exchanges. A single currency in Europe would knock a multi-billion hole into the derivatives market, and as I said, it costs us 50 million pounds for a small company. If you multiply this, the business world here and the financial institutions are dead against it. And before the attempt is made to unify it, there will be a huge backlash coming.
So are you saying there's sort of conspiracy afoot by the city to derail it?
I mean, you know, if you're Soros and you want to make money out of speculating against and for and make billions and then give £10,000 to charity afterwards and be a hero, then I think that is, you know, I think you would expect that kind of thing. I think I would rather address the question of how one can avoid this huge speculation that is going to try and kill this off and discuss how one can overcome that rather than this debate about whether it's 1.5% or 0.25% more or less in deficits or not.
Well, we've had a lot of views here and a lot of demons. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher, Soros, Kohl, the city, speculators, the convergence criteria. I would like to ask now if we can open this up to the floor, because I'm sure there are some people here who would like to put some questions to our panelists. Who would like to ask the first question? And could you stand up, speak quite loudly, and also identify yourself, please, and also not speak for too long?
Every other speaker has been attacking you on one theme, that the apparatus that you're discussing will do nothing for economic growth, really economic growth. And when you're asked to answer, you say, yes, that's true. Or you say, well, it's not a Keynesian system, I don't believe it. You do not give any reason to answer. You do not say why you do
it. Now you can.
Well, I try to give at least one hint without reproducing or engaging in a very deep academic debate. I try to give one hint by using the word of employer of last resort or the creator or provider of demand of last resort. That is evidently what you mean should be done in order to prop up demand. Who can provide the demand if it doesn't come from if the private sector doesn't generate it out of itself? It can only be supplied, provided by the government, by the public sector. Now, the public sector or the government is already in the red ever since we engaged in Keynesian policies in the early 70s. At that time, I found them very, very impressive and convincing. But now we're 20 years later, and the public deficits have piled up, and the debt has become a burden. In the federal budget, we have 100 billion Deutschmarks in interest payments every single year, and it's growing more and more. At the same time, we have a lot of non-budgeted payments in our books, so to say. They don't really show up in the books because they're not budgeted. But if we look at our welfare system, then we know that if it continues as it is, we'll have to put in even more public money or more money in the form of contributions. Actually, there's a striking difference, at least according to IMF findings, between this country and Germany. We have the IMF has come up with a study which says that in order to sustain the welfare system until mid next century, then in this country you would have to add 0.1 of GDP every year. In Germany it would be 3.3. So evidently something has to be done about the welfare system in Germany, but evidently we cannot go on piling up the debt.
Well, I think everybody agrees on that. Before going on to the next question, I think the next question is going to be Peter Warburton. I'd like to ask Mr. Nulling about this. You have, after all, been the one who's talking about mass unemployment. Can you just really tell us quite quickly how you would solve mass unemployment, if not through the sort of things that Mr. Reskow is talking about?
I mean, it shows the deplorable state of economic science and the application of economic science in practical policy, that a program is being designed with utter disregard for any demand, almost any demand aspect. I'm not advocating an employment program or so on. All I'm saying right now
a government which disregards entirely the negative growth effects of its so-called growth and employment program will not get far. That's all I'm saying.
But isn't, we don't have Keynesians now. I thought we had Helmut Keynes running the country after unification.
No.
The method of financing unification was to actually make more deficits. It didn't actually get Germany anywhere much, did it? It into a bit of a mess.
No, mistakes made in the past do not necessarily discredit the whole theory. So I would like to ask why this present government you are belonging to came into such a mess or developed such a mess. I mean, if we had a sensible supply-side policy and a sensible policy to reform our state, etc., etc., we are all agreeing on, we would not be in such a mess.
Mm. Well, we'll get on to that later. Peter Warburton. Perhaps you could come out so the people upstairs can hear you.
Well, I think that was the question you asked at the very beginning. I answered the question, at least from my narrow-minded perspective, because I'm not a member of the government, I'm just a civil servant. The point, as I said, the criteria have both a quantitative part in it, and they have also a kind of performance-related part of it. You have to see what has been the endeavors. You have to scrutinize what has been done over a certain period of time for most of the criteria, and in particular for the fiscal criteria. Now, that obviously and by definition can only be seen afterwards, ex post, and that is why first of all, it doesn't really make sense to express an opinion on that right now. But then also in political terms, I think it would be counterproductive. I mean, if anybody started saying, well, there's room between 3% and 4% as for the public deficit, then of course that would relax efforts in all
well,
parts.
Well, funnily enough, people from the Bundesbank are saying that, obviously not publicly, but I told you this on the telephone recently. We had a member of the Bundesbank at Robert Fleming saying that he could live easily with 3.5 or 3.6. I mean, is that acceptable?
I wonder whether he really can live with that easily, at least if he meets his colleagues next time. Probably would have a difficult time. On the other hand, I have another quotation. You may know Mr. Stoiber, the Premier of Bavaria. Well, his expression or his opinion on this was that anything that was beyond 3.02 was too much.
Mm. And you can't really agree or disagree with that. You simply take note of the fact that he says this.
Well, I favor strict application of the criteria, and I'm sure the EMI will make a very good, well-founded opinion at the beginning of 1998.
First, Anatole Kolecki, and then the gentleman in the red.
We heard earlier that Keynesian policy is to fail in the 70s, and therefore sense in the future, in the future. Well, in view of the failure of the Bundesbank policies over the last
year, I think I have to ask you to make a comment.
Should we not reject the idea of creating a European Bundesbank to run the future of Europe?
Yes, first Mr. Ryska and then maybe Mr. Nilling on that point.
Well, I totally disagree, of course, with this presentation of what has happened over the recent years. At the basis, or the rationale of what you're saying is, if you give away the value of money, then you can have all kinds of growth and of jobs. The Bundesbank has made a good record, has established a good record over 40 years, very soon it will be 50 years, to maintain a stable currency which protects the value of the money, and I think that was also at the basis of growth in Germany. I was also impressed by the comment I read today in your comment, Mr. Kaletsky, in the newspaper. I was utterly amazed to see there a certain degree of democratic fervor when you chastised the Bundesbank the future European Central Bank for not being democratically organized. Now, are you arguing that first of all that the Bank of England is a democratic organization, and do you think that submitting monetary decisions to democratic scrutiny or vote will provide us with a stable currency?
Mr. Ryska, you said you're not a politician.
Sorry.
You seem to have learnt something from Chancellor Kohl, because the best form of defence is indeed attack. Well, you can discuss that later, I'm sure. Mr. Nilling.
I'm not revealing a secret when I say that I quite often differed with regard to this particular point. Not always, and maybe not in a majority of cases. I mean, but that is the normal way to decide and to determine monetary and economic policy. You take, at the end, you take a vote.
But what about the future?
By and large, I would say I have no qualms with the Bundesbank's performance in this respect. But at certain times, I personally believed, and I was convinced by a majority who thought otherwise, that it was in the interest of stability of the German mark not to raise interest rates as much, as little as I had suggested, or to reduce it a little better, and so on and so on, all these finely tuned differences in opinion. You can debate this, and we have seen the graphs and so on, but by and large I would say the Bundesbank has done a responsible job over the long periods of activity.
The gentleman in the red.
My name is Alexis Kostos. I'm a Greek student, a Scottish student. Yes, see, my question is twofold.
Who is the question addressed to, please?
You mentioned the exchange rate costs. If you honestly feel, which as calculated by the CPI around something like 1%, would you honestly feel that those costs, saving those costs, are worth 20% unemployment in Spain and double digits unemployment in France? And secondly, do you feel that once, say, a common currency is established, that the government would actually have the guts to take the political decisions to coordinate their fiscal policies, thus avoiding an inflationary beast, which is what a common currency, as predicted, shall be?
Well, perhaps Robert Bischoff, the first part of the question, and Michael Stürmer, the second part.
It needs a politician to answer that, really. I give it a try. I mean, number one is, if you reduce cost, you can increase trade. And I think it's a fairly simple fact of life. And I think, let's come back to business. And I think if you cross borders and you've got no fears, and I'm not talking about the large companies investing in Britain or anything like that. I'm talking about the little companies trying to go across. They have to go to the Chamber of Commerce. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know whether they get paid. That's what hinders trade across borders, and that's what we're talking about. So in my opinion, the only way forward is to get out of unemployment. It's got absolutely nothing to do with the cost of of this, and 20 million Spaniards, I think, or unemployed people in Europe on the whole, I think the only way forward is to go forward and try to get rid of unemployment by growth and not by anything else, not by Keynes, not by all these other matters. Supply side measures to get the German economy in particular more flexible, not social cost down, that's more a question of exchange rates. And wage costs is a question of exchange rate. It's the inflexibility of the German workforce that is more hindrance than anything. If we can get those supply side things right, a better infrastructure so that we can communicate better with each other and easier cross-border traffic, then I think we can get more growth out of it and less unemployment in Europe. And that's the only way forward.
We can do them on the second point about fiscal policies.
Well, first of all, let me make one remark, if I may, David. I don't believe in all these quick fixes, all these transfer costs. If you have an initial group of five or six countries, and that's what we are talking about, Italy, Britain will not be in it, so the costs will stay, the yen and the United States will not be in it, and a few other high performers, very important markets, very important suppliers, will also not be in it. So what are we talking about? At present, the Deutschmark is the French currency, the Dutch currency, the Austrian currency, and a few other are pretty closely tied to the Deutschmark. The transfer risks are not high. They're almost negligible. Now, the question, the Anglo-Greek question, is a very serious one. Will governments have the guts, and will oppositions display the self-denial of making a killing? Of course not. Governments will not have the guts, because then they would not have to invoke the Maastricht criteria now. They would have done their homework long before. The German government would have done its homework before 89, not because Eurification was sort of beckoning round the corner, but because it would have been good anyway. And this government, the Kohl government 1982, promised a turnaround on many of these things, and they were all clearly to be seen. And the strength was not enough. There was a lot of strength, but it was not enough. And now, since 1981, 1982, when it became clear that reunification is much tougher, including financial terms, it was not so. And the French government has given in to a large extent. And very few governments have sort of followed gladly the Thatcherite revolution in this country. And look at Italy, Spain. And I absolutely refuse to accept that 20% of the Spanish unemployment are due to Europe or to stable money or something of the kind. No, these reasons are different. Now, we are really talking about democracy, the welfare state, and growth. And we are talking about this in an environment which we had for a long time of a stable or even growing population, of a balanced social contract, and of some effects of globalization, but not as dramatic and as cruel as they are now. Now the data framework has changed considerably, and that's where I feel the energy needed is much greater than it would have been 10 years ago. We are going through a valley of tears, and so far we've only put one of our toes into that valley of tears, but there's more to come.
Questioner Maurice Fraser.
This is really a question for Professor Learning. You expressed concern that it didn't make sense to run such a tight economic policy at this stage of the economic cycle. What do you say to the argument that we've heard already from one of the panelists? I think he also mentioned this in some of his articles, that not just German industrialists, but even at government level, private. Likely to be as hard as tight monetary policy as monetary policy.
Now, that gives a lot room for speculation what a new central bank council, how it would react to pressing needs and so on. You know, according to the statute, they have to live by. They are supposed to be as rigid and restrictive as we can imagine. And they will probably, in order to establish their credibility, or they might be more restrictive than the situation requires. I don't know. We don't know. We can guess about this. As far as the restrictiveness of our monetary policy is concerned at present, you have observed that it was lowered quite a bit. I mean, the interest rates have been brought down, and I understand that it had a certain detrimental effect recently on long-term interest rates. And we have always been concerned if we lower the short-term interest rates too much or too fast, it might have a negative effect on the long-term interest rates. This is an inherent, very, very difficult problem. I would hope to conclude this, I would hope that the Bundesbank feels in a position to go further down and to bring the interest rates further down. We have a real interest rate spread right now, which is much too high for recovery. But it is very difficult, as I said, to calibrate this, you know. Bundesbank has command directly only over the short-term rates. And in order to influence the long-term rates, that is not only up to the Bundesbank. Maybe if the program Mr. Raskau has defending here would really do the trick, it could combine positive effects. And that's where my doubts come in, you know, that this program is not doing us a favor to supplement and to support the monetary policy.
We're getting quite near the end of our advertised time now, but there is a question from the floor, and then I'm going to ask our panel a last round of questions. It's really, if you let in Belgium, will you have to let in Italy?
If you let in Italy, you let in Greece.
It is a sort of slippery slope question, isn't it?
Right.
And why we've asked Mr. Raskau to answer it.
I'll prefer to stay dry and high, and as I already said, I can't give a clear-cut answer to this. That's not the right time. We cannot know for the time being. And we'll have the opinion of other and more qualified institutions on the table before the finance ministers, and then afterwards the heads of states and government will make their vote. I don't, as I said, once you have the EMI opinion on the table, there won't be much leeway to fudge with the criteria. And that will also mean that you couldn't, for the sake of European unity and for a lot of political reasons, take Italy or Greece on board if the opinion of the EMI wouldn't warrant that. That is just the political process. Chancellor couldn't go afterwards to his electorate and say and still maintain he has fought for the stability of the currency. It's unthinkable, at least in the German political context.
Well, I'm now going to go into the end round of questions. I'm going to ask six questions, because I'm going to ask Mr. Raskau two. And this is really a sort of citation for his bravery in coming here today when Britain seems to have stopped cooperating with the rest of Europe. I'm very grateful you've come here to cooperate with us, and I think you should have a round of applause.
I read in the Sunday.
Yes. No. So you keep saying you're not a politician, but then you keep coming up with these wonderful political phrases like I read in The Sun the other day, but we're going to keep The Sun out of it.
Complete victory. You'll have complete victory.
Well, it's all rubbish.
Anyway,
the question is this ins and outs question, which has been raised. Now, it seems to me that we do live in a kind of de facto monetary union of a sort already in Europe, because we have 6 or 7 countries which more or less do have stable exchange rates vis-a-vis the D-mark, which we've had now for a number of years, give or take a few vicissitudes. Now, what is really going to be politically and economically profited by if we simply go in 1999 to an economic and monetary union with those countries with whom we already have quite a large amount of stability? And it seems to me all the criteria, even if we soften them a little bit, are all pushing us in that direction. We will have a core, which will be 6 or 7 countries with whom we already have stability. Will that really be such a great benefit, given the fact that the countries outside, the so-called outs, will possibly be destabilized, and they will not only have more freedom to devalue their currencies than before, they may also be pushed by the markets. Would that not be counterproductive?
Well, of course, the economic effects, and we haven't really discussed those, of EMU will be smaller. Their economies of scale will be smaller if the number of countries joining in the first wave is smaller. That is certainly true, and there's even a break-even point where the entire endeavor exercise might not be warranted anymore. If we take the present time where only Luxembourg fulfills all criteria, it is of course not a good idea now to establish a European Monetary Union consisting of Luxembourg. And for those who love paradoxes, and at the same time breaking apart the one monetary union that successfully exists, the one between Belgium and Luxembourg. So, of course, there is somewhere a point where the entire exercise would not be warranted, and very often German politicians have said that a monetary union without both Germany and France wouldn't really make sense. So much to smaller EMU, but then on EMS, if I may use that word, EMS Mark II, a reformed European monetary system, which would take care of those in the orbit around the euro. Well, that is precisely a system which is designed to avoid slippages and to bring those countries and currencies closer to the stable currency in the middle, which is the euro. But the basic difference, and that difference apparently is still needed at that level, is that in that realm of EMS2, of course, currencies and exchange rates are still adjustable. And that area needs a flexibility. And as we have seen after the widening of the exchange rate band from 2.25% to 15%, well, yes, ever since we have come back to calm financial markets.
So, right, thank you. So that all depends on the ERM2 in a way, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Bob Bischoff, I'd like to ask you a question which builds on that. You live in Britain, you seem to like it here. You talk about Our City, which is wonderful, a theme for Leighton Buzzer. Maybe you were talking about Leighton Buzzer.
Of course.
Do you wish Britain were to be part of this this new Eurozone, and do you think it will be? Do you think it's going to actually be realistic?
I mean, first, just before I answer that, I think if everybody here is in principle for it, in my company we always have got everybody is for everything in principle, but then they find every reason not to do it afterwards. And it needs really sort of a promoter and strong leadership to do these things and then, you know, face the consequences and do it. I think that's very, very important. I think, and I think that is going to happen. But I still think for Britain, it is dangerous to go in at the present time, because, as I said before, to remain competitive, we have gone from 11 marks 20 now to 2 marks 20 over all these years, and we needed those competitive devaluations to stay in the game, so to speak. And even at 220 last year, a 20 billion trade deficit with Germany. Those are the facts. I mean, Germans always say we want to learn from the Brits and all the rest of it. But if we learn, you know, if the Germans learn too much from the Brits, then either the deficit or the surplus from Germany will be 40 billion, or it may be zero. You know, if they really learn too much. So, but I think we need performance convergence, and we need systems convergence in the economic model. That the shareholder is no longer the totally dominating factor, but that there is room and a more long-term view in businesses. And if British companies can then really compete on level playing fields with their European and their Japanese competitors, then the time will have come that we can safely go into the EMU, not before.
Thomas Keening, I would like to look at you as the person who can read the soul of Chancellor Kohl. And I make no apologies for coming back to this man, because he has such a great influence on the future of Europe, if only because there are very many other leaders with much less stature. Can you imagine him going on television at some time in the next 12 months and simply saying, I'm sorry, I wanted monetary union, I still do, but I'm very, very sorry, it just hasn't worked, we're just going to have to put this off?
That I suppose would be out of character with his way of approaching the policy mass, as if I use his track record in office for 14 years. He is a man who would like, if he could, to prevaricate and wait for circumstances to change in a way that will then allow him to follow suit, whichever way the circumstances change in, rather than go out and determine to say to everyone. Now that would be an act of leadership. I don't think you can expect him to say that. Largely also because he invested so much in staying the course, or doing what Alexander Pope once said, the divine right of kings to govern wrong. Mr. Kohl will persist in his right to govern wrong. He will continue in the pursuit of unhappiness and follow these criteria until the rest of the world will get him off the hook and allow him to sort of grudgingly fall in with other people. But he has gone so far, as I think at this stage, and apart from the fact that it would be out of his character, he likes to just let it go on. And
So you're really saying he would rather like President Chirac to go on TV first, but then the next day there would be a national service of reconciliation between France and Germany at Notre Dame Cathedral, with a lot of handshaking, and to say we don't actually blame anybody. That might be the better way of doing it, maybe.
Probably that's the way it's going to come. But he's not going to pull the communication cord, or the community cord, or the emergency cord, whatever way you look at it.
Michael Stürmer, and we're getting into the last three questions now, because as I say, Michael Oskar is going to have the last question, because he's really deserved that tonight. Michael Stürmer, we haven't really focused all that much on the business community, and I'm going to ask you, almost as a representative of German business, because a lot of these tycoons, I think, they come to see you to seek guidance of various sorts. Now, it seems as though the business community in Germany is behind EMU because people want stability and they also want a slightly weaker currency. Is that going to actually prove decisive in the final analysis, this support of these business leaders who are mostly rather unknown to the general public?
I think it's a very important point. If they give their stamp of approval, if they come out strongly in favor, and Koppe of Deutsche Bank has done so, Schrempf of Daimler-Benz has done so, that's a very, very important thing. But at the same time, the shares of many companies, including Deutsche Bank, including Daimler-Benz, are doing better when jobs are being shed than if they keep their workforce. There's a big problem. And these guys, much as they are knowledgeable about industry and big business, they don't have to carry the political responsibility. For them, the political problem of how to manage Europe, how to further European integration, and not to make EMU the big wedge of Europe between the ins and the outs, because this will not be so harmonious. I mean, at present it's not harmonious, and it will not be harmonious. There will be enormous pressures, and all these countries have to adjust to the pressures from outside and from inside. the governments have to display enormous leadership, and industrialists, it's not their job to think in terms of, say, the whole range of politics. From the business point of view, yes, fine. Then Daimler-Benz would save more than half a billion marks if there were no, if they wouldn't have to hedge against the vicissitudes of currencies. But, and they say it's only within the European band, it's only on the European map. It's not the dollar, not the yen. Well, that's a lot. But they do not explain, of course, how they propose to get Greece and Italy, even Belgium, into the union. So they have a one-dimensional view, and that is pretty understandable. But politicians, and also journalists to a large extent, have to have a broader view. And that's my concerns are really, what will EMU do to Europe? Is it the great panacea to bring Europe together and we live happily ever after? Or if there is no political framework, no fusion of important, of key policies, will it force Europe apart?
I'd like to ask Wilhelm Nulling a question, putting you almost as a man of the people, which I know in a way you are, in a way you're not. One side of you, I think, doesn't really want to get too involved too much and wants to let them get on with their mistakes. But another one does want to stride into the arena. And of course, you're not really representative of the German people because you're probably far too intelligent and also far too humorous. You are a very humorous man. But
may I say yes as an answer?
But the point is, the German people, as far as we can see, are very suspicious about this. You pointed this out before to us. Is this really a question which can be somehow fixed in the next couple of years? Or is it going to provide a hindrance in political, legal, technical terms?
Excuse me, David. What did you mean exactly? What could get fixed on
that? The skepticism of the German people, is that something which somehow can be corrected by some sort of public relations campaign?
Yes.
Which you were
not public
about.
Relations campaign. Not
we are expecting a public relations campaign pretty soon. We will see what it contains. I fear that there will be no mentioning whatsoever with regard to risks involved and especially what the costs are that we have to bear. And even if it does not come off the ground, then the costs will have to be written off, of course. Now, as far as anxiety of German people is concerned, I think it is there, deeply ingrained, and I sense this when we talk to people, and quite often I get invitations to tell what I think about what the union is about and so on and so on. And I sense that they have not forgotten this deep traumatic thing, either told by their parents or experienced themselves, of two currency reforms, one in 1923 and one in 1948. So whether you might like to call it D-Mark fetishism, like people do, it is a deeply ingrained anxiety. And if a government does not take this into consideration, it takes a certain combination of forces. I cannot envisage right now. Social Democrats, my party, are not in a position because they are split along the middle. You know, they are Social Democrats, unfortunately, who believe as much in it like Mr. Raskow does. And so it's very difficult to establish a coherent policy in this respect. And that is one major point why it is so difficult to crystallize a sentiment against it. It will depend on how events go, and when it becomes clear to everybody, even to the most remote living farmer and so on, that the criteria cannot be met, and we are in an economic mess of unheard of proportions in the post-war period, then hope might be justified that even Chancellor Kohl might forgive it. Now, the problem is, as long as he thinks it can be done, it might take too long to stop the train. You know, that is my problem, that when banks and industry says, look, now we have invested 10 billion marks, 15 billion marks, we have done all the preparatory things in an administrative way, why stopping it now because of the damned or goddamned figures the EMI has been producing? And here comes the suspicion that he will go ahead because pressure is being applied by banks and industries because of the reasons I mentioned. And in this respect, what can you do when there is no voice, when people have no representation in the political parties? How can they defend their interests if such a situation occurs? In this respect, I'm a little more pessimistic than about a year or two ago.
Well, the final question, which is only right and proper, is to Mikhail Ryskar. And this is a question to you, obviously, as a civil servant, not as a politician. You are a civil servant, although you don't really dress like one, I must say. In fact, this is a really superb example of the new Germany, that your yellow tie and your flamboyance compared with the average British civil servant, or even the average British banker, actually. And I think it's a great advantage. But imagine you are a civil servant being asked this by Mr. Weigel in his chamber, and you are asked to produce a paper. Are you sure that the political, technical, constitutional, legal framework as of now is sufficiently in place to make the supposition that a single currency will take place in 1999, to make that more likely to be a success than a failure? And we all know that if there were to be a failure, it would be a very deep one. Would you provide Mr. Weigel with a yes, minister, or a no, but? What would your balance of arguments be on the state of play now? I'm not asking you to look into the future, I'm asking you the situation now in terms of our preparation for this mighty event.
Let me split the question into two points. When you talk about conditions, then the first condition I wouldn't understand it is as, are the conditions in place to make the euro a stable and successful currency? And there again, I would say as long as we mind the criteria, as we mind strict application of the criteria, the currency, the euro joint and single currency is to be a success. So these conditions are firmly in place. On all the other conditions, we have made some progress, and in particular, I think I'm sorry for being a little evasive, but there is a point to make. We are successful on some criteria, in particular price stability, and that has taught the Germans also that they are not the only beholders of stability. That stability is a model that is spreading out over Europe, and that others can do the same, and that gives it additional assurance to this joint effort, which will be EMU. Now, on the fiscal criteria, well, I can only state that they are, in a Kantian way, is it a categorical imperative that we all have to do what we can in order to fulfill the criteria. As for Germany, I can say, this program that is being discussed in the public covers an amount of 50 billion Deutschmarks in savings, both for the budget, the federal budget, for the lender budgets, for social security. Now that's 1.5 percentage points of GDP. So. Well, with a little arithmetic, but there are other points to it. Mr. Nölling would probably hint to it. You realize that if this program gets through, then the chances are very good that we'll be below 3% and clearly below 3%. But we're only at the beginning of the process. We have our own national debate. We'll have the problems with opposition and trade unions, and others are in no better situation. I know about the problems of the French, and I suppose in this country as well, there will be a lot of resistance. Now, the only answer to that is we have to do what we can to go through this experience and this scrutiny.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lesko. I think Mr. Weigel would have put at the bottom of that paper, that man will go far. I would like now to start to draw the proceedings to an end with the help of Howard Machen, Herr de Hector Machen, who is standing in the background. I would simply like to say for my part how enriching I think this debate has been conducted, and we must say that with great humility, in the future language of European monetary policy, i.e. in English, because it's a little known fact that the European Central Bank, with a Dutch president, a French vice president, an Italian, a Luxembourger, an Irish, a Danish, Belgian members of the directorate, it will discuss, and the Germans, of course, it will discuss and promulgate its monetary policy affairs in English. I think that's something which the Germans maybe have not yet thought of, but I must say it is, for me, a very enriching experience. I would like to say thank you to Mr. Röskar, to Mr. Kiene, to Mr. Nerling, to Mr. Bischoff, to Mr. Stürmer for coming here and talking to us, and I would like to hand over to Howard Machen.
Thank you for coming.